This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Some of the greatest advances in the past 7 or 8 decades have come from the laboratory. In those labs, some of the finest and most powerful minds in the country work to save lives. There does seem to be an issue that is causing problems. They mix up the labels on their specimens a lot.
We thought it highly important to further improve our quality, especially in this critical area, because for us, the only acceptable labeling error rate is zero.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a new system that's working to end those errors. We'll also head to the coast of Maine, where a special program is changing the lives of high school girls. And we'll spend an academic minute with lies and the lying liars who tell them. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Let's say you go to the doctor to get some tests. It's pretty routine. You wait for the results. They come in. Your doctor treats you. You get better. We all live happily ever after. Problem is, sometimes your test results are not yours. The latest published error rates for clinical labs in the U.S. are just over 1%. Now, that may sound low, but it means hundreds of thousands of mislabeled specimens and incorrect lab reports. A report in the March 2014 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry describes an automated device with 4 cameras used to photograph the outside of a specimen tube. The system then uses optical character recognition to look for discrepancies between the patient name in a lab information system compared to the patient name on the tube label. Here to talk about this new system is one of the authors of that report, Dr. Charles Hawker. Dr. Hawker is Scientific Director of Automation and Special Projects at ARUP Laboratories and an Adjunct Professor of Pathology at the University of Utah School of Medicine. We spoke recently, and I asked Dr. Hawker what prompted the development of this system.
There are two answers. First, our own laboratory, which is a very large reference laboratory, and we test many thousands of specimens each day, routinely monitors mislabeled specimens. Based on the published studies from the College of American Pathologists and other groups, we believed our error rate was much lower than the average rates in the U.S. laboratories. Nevertheless, we thought it highly important to further improve our quality, especially in this critical area, because for us, the only acceptable labeling error rate is zero. But there's a second part of the answer, and that is that about 7 or 8 years ago, I was having a conversation with my former supervisor, Dr. William Roberts, who unfortunately passed away in 2012. We were chatting about possible future automation projects, and Bill said we ought to try to solve the problem of mislabeled specimens. And I'm not making this up, but I sort of scratched my head and replied that maybe some kind of high-speed camera system using OCR could do that. And then instantly I discounted my own idea because I didn't think it would be possible. But a seed had been planted, and over the ensuing months, I learned about some of these machine vision and camera systems and began exploring the idea with various manufacturers. Then, even after we found the manufacturer with the leading systems, we still went down several different paths, tried several different prototypes before we were able to develop the system that's described in the paper and then validate its performance.
Well, what kind of a problem are we talking about? How serious are the labeling error rates in U.S. labs?
Well, I think they're quite serious. The College of American Pathologists has published the results of several studies that they've done called Q-probe studies. These are surveys that they send to their participating laboratories, which consist of questions to which the labs can choose whether to respond. It's purely voluntary. In the published surveys about labeling errors, the number of responding labs was typically 120 to 150 laboratories, which is really only a fraction of all the laboratories in the country, but it's still an appreciable number in terms of the significance of the findings, especially if one considers that the labs likely to respond might be those that routinely measure their error rate and think that their performance is reasonably good. So at any rate, in 2 of these published surveys of routine clinical laboratories, the published labeling error rates were 0.39 per 1,000 specimens, and 0.92 per 1,000 specimens. Then even worse, however, there was another study conducted in 122 labs handling blood bank specimens for which the reported labeling error rate was 1.12%. This is a really scary number. In fact, all of those numbers to me are scary. And I don't often mention this when I'm just talking to the general public because it reflects rather poorly on the laboratory community. The laboratorians understand how hard it is to do this kind of work and have a better perspective on error rates than I think the public might have.
What are some of the most important features of the system described in your article?
Well, first, the robotic system had to lift the tubes by the caps because we didn't want the grippers to cover the label since we were trying to photograph the label, and that would make the label not readable. As a reference laboratory, we receive a very large assortment of specimen tubes of different sizes with different types of caps. So the robotic system has a smart camera and a backlight. And together, these measure the height and the diameter of the tube and the shape and the diameter of the cap so that the robot can precisely grasp the cap and lift the tube out of the automated track carrier. Then the vision system consists of four very powerful, they're 5-megapixel cameras, and a strobe lighting system in order to obtain very high resolution photographs. The system then stitches the four photographs together to make a single photograph, which is really a two-dimensional view of the entire exterior of the tube. The software then orients the photograph so that our laboratory's label and the client's label are always in standard locations in this image. It then queries our laboratory information system, our LIS, to determine the patient name in our record, and then it uses what's called an OCR engine, that's optical character recognition, to see if a matching character string is on the client's label. In addition, both the robot system and the vision system have to perform at a very high speed in order to keep up with our automation. Presently, the total cycle time is about 3 seconds, but we're working to reduce that to 2 seconds. We hope to limit the total robotic time to about a second and the vision system time to about a second. However, if one considers what we are doing with this present system, even 3 seconds is very impressive. Another critical element is that every one of our clients seems to have their own unique formats for their labels. The labels vary all over the place in the location, format, and fonts that are used for the patient name. And then sometimes labs write on the labels or circle the name, and this can interfere with the system. The technology that we are using was developed for high-speed pharmaceutical plants or bottling companies, where every bottle of aspirin is identical and the OCR system is simply trying to read lot numbers, expiration dates, or similar data. It's always in the same location, format, and font as these bottles are very rapidly going past the cameras on a conveyor system. When these engineers first saw the huge variety of tubes and labels that we handle, they weren't even sure that this was possible. The fact that this system is working so well is, I think, a tribute to the genius of our vision systems engineer. Our system works best when the text on the client label reads from left to right with the tube's cap or stopper at the left end of the photograph. In other words, as though you were holding the tube in your left hand and you were able to read the label. And it works best if the patient name is at the left end of the first line of text. However, we receive labels in which the patient name is anywhere from the first line to the fifth line of the label, and it's not always on the left. Sometimes the patient name is split on two lines, or it's within a colored stripe, or it uses a reverse font in which the printing is white against a black background or a black rectangle. All of these are issues that will prevent this system from working. So it's a real challenge.
So is there any hope that someday the specimen labels for all of these laboratories in the country might be at least better standardized?
Yes, I definitely have that expectation. In 2011, the Clinical and Laboratory Standards Institute, or CLSI, published a standard, Auto 12A, that is specifically focused on the content and formats of specimen labels. Over the next couple of years, it is expected that the College of American Pathologists, which inspects laboratories, and the Joint Commission, which inspects hospitals, will both reference this standard in their checklist questions, and that this will push laboratories to adopt the standard for their own labels. Our laboratory is already working to adopt the standard, but so far, it doesn't appear that many of the laboratories who send their reference testing to us have yet adopted it. So if our clients do implement this standard, it would obviously benefit our OCR system. But the real reason the CLSI developed the standard was specifically to reduce the labeling error rates that occur in the U.S. laboratories and to improve patient safety.
Has your laboratory seen a benefit in terms of improved patient safety?
We definitely have. There's no question about that. Even though we just have the one existing prototype machine, we are running it 24 hours a day on our production automation system with routine specimens because we want to gather more data and continue to make improvements on its performance. It is only run on one of our four automation tracks, so only about a quarter of our daily workload is passing through the system. But because all of that volume is going to one large laboratory section, it's fairly easy for us to measure the impact of finding the mislabeled specimens prior to analysis, and thus to measure how many errors we're preventing. Moreover, we aren't yet running it with a process of rapid review of the failed images that we plan to do when we go into full production with more advanced systems. In that setting, our automation would route to an inspection station where the failed specimens would be instantly picked up and inspected by a technician. However, we have seen a measurable decrease in corrected reports due to mislabeled specimens that we've had to issue to clients, and as of this time, we've run approximately 2.5 million specimens through this system. So the improvement in patient safety or the reduction of errors is quite evident.
Well, finally, Dr. Harker, let's look ahead. What do you think the future holds for this system?
In our laboratory, we plan to build new production units with better robotic systems and faster vision systems that utilize more powerful computers. Our present vision system computer is more than 4 years old. So just based on Moore's law, a new computer could shave perhaps a half second off the cycle time. But there are other refinements in both speed and pass rate that we think are possible. So ultimately, then, we plan to implement these new units on our entire automation system. And once this occurs, I believe that our error rate due to mislabeled specimens will improve significantly. Only about 85% of our total daily workload of our laboratory is on our automation system. But if there is a near zero error rate on that 85% of our volume, that will be an incredible outcome in terms of improved patient safety. In addition, I should mention that we have not patented this system. The components could be purchased from our vendor and designed and built to work on most of the major automation systems that laboratories purchase today. They're expensive, but for high-volume laboratories, I think that cost will be justified by this possibility of near-total elimination of mislabeled specimens and improved patient safety.
Dr. Charles Hawker is Scientific Director of Automation and Special Projects at ARUP Laboratories and an Adjunct Professor of Pathology at the University of Utah School of Medicine. You can learn more about this system in the March 2014 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Still to come, students from Maine are getting a unique educational experience by the sea. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1217. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Coastal Studies for Girls, or CSG, is a new marine science and leadership program in Freeport, Maine. Sophomore girls from around the country attend the school each semester. Anna Pinkert caught up with one of these girls and found out how the hands-on program has changed her life.
Picture your 10th grade science class. You've got some beakers, maybe those black lab desks, and a guy with a bow tie droning on. At Coastal Studies for Girls, this is what 10th grade science sounds like.
I don't get trapped in the mud. I am a mud creature.
Yeah, this is Freeport, Maine. We're next to the little river outside in the mud flats, in the water.
This is our science project for the end of the year.
Pretty much write our own research plan.
We're studying knotted wrack,
scuds, and how they respond to motor oil in the water.
Smooth periwinkles,
palm periwinkle, Littorina littorea,
blue mussels, and barnacles.
Back at the Coastal Studies farmhouse, there are actually some beakers and a few buckets full of specimens gathered from the Maine coast.
We chose to work with the green crab, which is an invasive species.
Laura Nunez dunks her hand into an icy tank to pull up a female crab.
She doesn't like it, though.
Yeah.
She's trying to pinch me. If you listen to them, they make bubbles in
right.
their mouth. We don't exactly know why, but it's sort of like people think it's how they communicate.
Right.
It's easy to spot Laura when the group is out on their regular field trips. She has flashy red highlights in her long black hair and a silver nose ring that reflects the afternoon sun.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I guess.
You guess?
Yeah, I guess. Well, it smells, but it's cool.
Now Laura is easy about picking up a crab or chomping through the mudflats, but she grew up in Los Angeles, and before CSG, Laura hadn't experienced quite this much nature.
I remember going out into the mudflats in Charlotte. She's sailed for a while, and she's just, like, walking through the mud and picking up, like, eelgrass and other rockweeds and stuff, and just grabbing all these really gross-looking things and smelly things, and I was like, whoa.
At first, Laura felt distant from the other girls. Many come from privileged backgrounds, while Laura's family has struggled financially.
I feel like I'm a really wise person and I have a really great heart, but I just haven't done as many things as they have done, maybe because it's financially, or I just haven't been aware of all these opportunities. So, I mean, I've spent my nights crying a couple of nights, and I felt uncomfortable, and sometimes I wonder if I even, like, what I'm doing here, if I really belong here. But then I think to myself, it's like, everyone's being really nice, and none of them are seeing this except for me. I'm the only person who knows this. So maybe it'd be different if they knew how I felt or my life and my experience. And there's no way I'm leaving. I mean, I'd be the weak one if I left.
Since those first weeks, Laura says she's built a sisterhood with the other girls. But she still misses her mom, her sister, and her baby brother. She's had trouble getting a hold of them.
My mom got unemployed, and so did her husband. So things have been really weird and difficult. It's the whole day I look forward to choice time because I'm busy all the time, and then I always have hope that, like, I'm gonna get a response or something, but I'm not getting a response.
Laura's mom came to this country illegally before Laura was born. Her family lives paycheck to paycheck. Laura's mom wants her to have financial security, to become a doctor. That's something that Laura wanted too, but since coming to CSG, her world has kind of exploded.
I mean, I really love biology and I love sciences, but there's a part of me that's more like artistic writer, and I really like writing and I love literature, and I feel like I'd love to do that for a living, to write. I think in a way my mom values that less.
What are you gonna wear?
I'm gonna wear a Blair's shirt.
Tonight is unusual at CSG. The girls are getting ready for their literary coffee house. Everyone is searching for dressy clothes at the bottom of drawers mostly full of rain pants and practical winter gear.
So I'm just borrowing, and I brought some of my church pants, so I'm going to wear my church pants.
These days, Laura is trying not to think too much about going back to L.A.
It's weird being here and all these things happening and you not being able to help or contribute in any type of way, so I sort of don't know what to expect once I get back home.
The dining hall has been transformed into a performance space. Paper lanterns hang above a podium draped in the CSG flag. The girls aren't usually allowed caffeine, so tonight they drink decaf out of espresso-sized cups. The girls can barely contain their excitement. There's been a lot of last-minute makeup swapping. Laura wears the same cherry red lipstick as a few other girls. She's the first one at the podium.
I realized I loved Maine after the first week of arriving at CSG. Maine's coast and forest is so full of life and beauty. How do I make people understand? Most importantly, how do I make my family understand that I have changed? I want to stay, and I don't know what I want out of life anymore. How do I explain the fiery passion inside of me that longs to explore and be independent?
I think it's really important to embrace yourself. If you begin to understand who you are and why you like the way you are, it sort of helps you love other things too and see how everything plays a role together.
Lights out at CSG is at 10 p.m., but the girls are too wound up to sleep. A dance party breaks out in the dorm, and even one of the resident advisors joins in. Laura has found community here, and she's grateful.
We're learning life skills, leadership skills, like the power in women and feminism. It's been a lot of reflecting and a lot of journaling and a lot of thinking since I've been here. I've had a lot of time to think. So I feel like I've had a couple of revelations here.
Christian, you're awesome! Gotta let
go. For Salt Radio, I'm Anna Pinkert.
Well, to the best of our knowledge, everything we've told you so far today is the truth. See what I did there? But once you do start lying, it appears there's no going back. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College.
As the old adage says, lying can create a tangled web of falsehoods, partial truths, and denials. Sean Lane, associate professor of psychology at Louisiana State University, discusses the liar's dilemma and the slippery nature of truth in the wake of deception.
Have you ever wondered how liars keep their story straight? After all, to avoid getting caught, they have to remember both when they lied and when they told the truth. It turns out that one key to answering this question concerns how hard your brain has to work to produce a lie. I study two different kinds of lies: false descriptions, the deliberate invention of things that never actually occurred, and false denials, denying something that really did take place. False descriptions turn out to be much easier to remember because, in short, they take a lot of brain power to generate and thus leave a stronger residue in our memories. When subjects in our study were asked to recall false descriptions 48 hours later, their memories were accurate. False denials take little mental effort and leave less evidence behind. These same test subjects had a hard time remembering their own false denials after 48 hours. This research has serious implications for forensic interrogations, because our subjects also had a difficult time remembering if their denials were true or false. This relates to a concept called the illusory truth effect, the idea that telling the truth can actually lead to a false memory. A man who repeatedly denies seeing a knife at a crime scene, for example, might actually begin to believe he saw it, even if it was never there. It feels familiar to him, and because the repeated denials have slipped from his memory, he ends up thinking it must have happened. Research to better understand the intricacies behind lying will provide investigators with better tools to avoid convicting innocent individuals and ensure that savvy criminals don't get to walk away without punishment.
That was Sean Lane of Louisiana State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.